Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers, even Spotify and also YouTube. And it's Dark Mark, the goth comedian, and I'm here with my co-host, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Six.
Hello. How's everyone doing?
Actually, podcasts are colliding this week. We have two podcasts in one this week because I am joined by Lisa Ann Goldsmith and Owen Thompson from the Bardcast, It's Shakespeare, You Dick podcast, award-winning podcast. They just won an award as the best podcast by New York Shakespeare. Just New York Shakespeare. I don't even know. Is that a website? Is that a...
It's what is New York, the New York Shakespeare Awards. They've been around only a couple of years. And so it's run by a wonderful gentleman named Rodney Hakim, who he and his team select. They are kind of incredibly comprehensive. They consume and listen to more Shakespeare than you can shake. Like I couldn't do it myself. They see every show, they see every movie, they listen to every podcast, they read every book,
every article. It's amazing.
It's amazing. And so every year now they come out with these awards, and they have awards like not only their favorite production and best actor and best actress, but categories like hardest working person in Shakespeare. We were in the category of best audio performance and podcast.
Best teacher, best classes, all of that kind of stuff.
All of that stuff. Best book. So we were fortunate enough.
Podcasts, you're competing against podcasts and audio performances. Yes,
that is correct. That is correct. We didn't know we were in. We didn't have any idea we were in that kind of competition. We know Rodney, but we were surprised when we were nominated, and then we were really surprised when we won. Pleasantly, of course.
Which happened pretty soon after. Like, we just found out we were nominated, and then the next week we won. We didn't know anything about it.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yes. Thank you.
It's exciting.
You were practicing your it's just an honor to be nominated speech, and then you won.
That's
then
right. But we were kind of honored to be nominated.
You could have knocked us over with a feather.
But I Googled top Shakespeare podcasts, and there's a couple lists that you're right on there as well. So you definitely apparently have one of the best Shakespearean podcasts.
Because we're funny and fun and irreverent, and you know, we don't love everything. We don't love everything Shakespeare. There's certain plays that we're like, that's a piece of shit.
Right.
You know, we're honest about it. So.
And
he wasn't perfect.
Lisa Ann actually has played Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, as well as acted with Russell Crowe on screen and other things. And Owen has been an actor, director for many years, worked with the legendary Quentin Crisp long ago, and is still just Shakespeare in the Park. He's done everything. And we're gonna get into them and get into Shakespeare and talk all sorts of things. But before we do, you know, if Shakespeare was alive today and he had to stay up and write his plays, he probably would need a good energy drink. And I tell you, the best energy drink he should be drinking is Ray's energy drinks. Unfortunately, I've got some voodoo flavor on the way, and it didn't arrive. It's arriving later today, but that's delicious. That tastes like fruit punch. They have Baja Lime that tastes like Baja Blast with Taco Bell. They have sour gummy worms. They have a pina colada flavor. They have a strawberry colada flavor. All sorts of great flavors. And the best part, zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash. So you don't have to drink it on a cheat day. You can drink it every day. Ray's energy drinks. Go to the description in any podcast catcher you're listening to this or on YouTube, and you will get 15% off a case and buy it by the case, because you'll be going through it every day and you'll be wide awake and ready to write your sonnets. So before we get into your respective biographies, which are very impressive and still ongoing, I loved the show last week for a couple of reasons. The most recent one I haven't gotten to, but this was Shakespeare's contemporaries. Because this always was bothering me, because you know, if you say who's the greatest playwright right now or of the 20th century or 21st century, there's any number of names. Say the 20th century, you could say Sam Shepard, you could say David Mamet, you could say Terrence McNally, you could say anybody, Lin-Manuel Miranda, whoever, you know, whatever. And they're all different, but Shakespeare is the only one really from that era that's canonized. And I didn't know if there were other good playwrights of that era. And
dozens and dozens. That particular pod was one that I was looking forward to doing for a long time. You're absolutely right. It's like people think of the Shakespeare's era and they study Shakespeare. It's like people only studying Tennessee Williams and thinking about the 20th right. century. Of course, everybody writes in context. Everybody has influences. Everybody, you know, has contemporaries, and Shakespeare was no different. I mean, the main difference is really that Shakespeare and his contemporaries were in a way inventing what we think of as theater now. I mean, there before that, in England at any rate, it was mostly mystery plays and that sort of thing that were done by local Bible stories that were performed by local tradesmen in different towns for on holidays and at festivals and things like that. But as London grew and as the government became centralized, a lot of people gravitated towards London and people started writing plays and entrepreneurs started opening theaters. So it's really just before Shakespeare starts writing in the 1590s that theater as a profession and acting and writing as professions start to take off. And they were very disreputable, sometimes very profitable, but not very reputable. And they were, people thought of actors the same way they thought of prostitutes, really.
Wow.
But Shakespeare had, and
Harvey Weinstein still does.
Inappropriate.
So yeah, Shakespeare had dozens of contemporaries.
Some beautiful, beautiful plays. Some are well known, but most aren't. Shakespeare has kind of eclipsed them all.
Right, yeah. And I guess this is near to your heart because you put on Revenger's Tragedy, which you referenced many a time on the show.
I'm a little obsessed with that play. I've produced it. I actually wrote a master's thesis on that play as well, many years later. So yeah, I'm a little obsessed. And that's an interesting play in that most people today attribute it to an author named Thomas Middleton, who's one of the playwrights that we talk about on the Shakespeare Contemporaries podcast, who is an incredibly prolific and talented playwright of Shakespeare's day. Previously, that play was attributed to a different author. I personally think the safest attribution is to Anonymous, the ever popular Anonymous, because it's hard to pin down with any real certainty who wrote it. But it's with a name like Dark Mark, you might like this play because it's very goth. The first half is so the premise of this play, and stop me if I'm boring you, but the premise of this play is there's a guy named Vindice, which basically means a revenger, and he's carrying around the skull of his dead girlfriend. And he's been carrying it for 9 years because she was murdered by the evil duke of his country who wanted to have sex with her and she wouldn't do it. So he raped her and killed her. And this guy's been carrying her head for all of this time. And then eventually he wangles his way. He disguises himself and he gets a job in the court. And his you know, what he wants to do is murder the duke. Well, so in order to do this, he and his brother dress the skull up as a woman. They hide it. And like with veils and that kind of thing. And they poison the mouth of the skull with acid. And they convince the Duke that they've got a girl for him. And they bring him to the secluded area. And he kisses what he thinks is a woman, but it's really the poison skull. And then through the rest of the scene, his face is basically eaten off by the acid while the two brothers make him watch his wife and his bastard son have sex in front of him because they're having an affair. And then they kill him. And that's the end of the first half.
Right. Well, I've been on worse blind dates myself, but it sounds like one of Nicole's stories.
It does. It sounds like something I would write. I did have a question, though. Was Shakespeare also treated like trash, like street rubbish, when he first started out? I imagine certainly.
When he first started out. I mean, the more famous he became and the higher patronage he got, the better he was treated.
Yeah, he was actually eventually really, really successful. He died very, very wealthy. It largely because he was not only a famous actor and then later a famous playwright, but he also had an actual share of the company that he was part of that later became the King's Men. So the King was actually their patron. But we just found something out on our most recent pod doing research for it. It seems that when he was a young man, Shakespeare may have been hired muscle for local bad guys.
He was a goon. Shakespeare was a goon.
Shakespeare was a thug?
Possibly. It's been unearthed. There's a restraining order, very obscure restraining order that was taken out against William Shakespeare and a few other people because of a death threat. And the people who are involved were rival theater owners and some corrupt guys. And it looks like Shakespeare may have been a hired goon as a young man.
Wow.
I know, right? Like, you never think of that.
Yeah, Shakespeare in Love should have had James Gandolfini play him instead of Justin.
I was going to say, right? More buff than we think.
And he was very litigious. Like, he was involved in a lot of lawsuits.
Yeah, wow. one of the ways that we know as much as we know about Shakespeare, because, you know, famously there are missing records, but he shows up in different legal proceedings. For instance, he went because he was a wealthy landowner at a certain point. He bought up a lot of land in Stratford, and apparently, this is again not so nice. He apparently hoarded grain and sold it at illegally inflated prices to people who were hungry.
Yeah,
during famines. It's awful, but it seems to be true.
Wow. He really does sound like a mafia thug.
Yeah. He was kind of a dick, if you will.
Well, at least it's not buying that, but it's a dick that has a way with flowery language. So,
For sure.
Yeah, so it's...
And I mean, you know, one thing really has nothing to do with the other. He was, one thing is a businessman, another thing is an artist, so...
Right. Well, go ahead, Nicole.
I just said valid point.
Right.
Yeah, what was... Nicole, what is your experience with Shakespeare? Did you like it as a kid? Did you follow
it? I didn't like him as a kid. Not like an 8-year-old, obviously, but like it as a teenager when I was old enough to understand Shakespeare. I like The Tempest. I like A Midsummer Night's Dream. Much Ado About Nothing. Much Ado is Shakespeare, right? I just realized that.
Yeah. Nicole obviously knows more than I do, but go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like the comedies. I think his comedies are a lot of fun. I always like the comedies more than the tragedies.
The problem is that when they teach it in schools, you know, in high schools, they don't teach it properly. Like, you know, our very first episode was called Filthy Shakespeare. And it was, you know, my partner said to me afterwards, he goes, you know, when we were doing Romeo and Juliet in high school, I always thought to myself, is that a dick joke? But I thought, no, it's Shakespeare. It can't be a dick joke. Well, it is.
It is.
And they don't tell you that. And I think a lot more kids would be way more interested if they knew that. They're like, there's like sex and filth jokes all through Shakespeare.
Oh yeah. He's what I always tell my students is if you're reading Shakespeare and you think it's a dirty joke, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're disguised by, you know, because some of the language is a little hard to penetrate, as it were. he was very bawdy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I also really like
William Dice Shakespeare. And
Taming of the Shrew was one of those ones that was definitely twisted and fun.
Yep. You have pre-spousal abuse in that show.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. And I mean, think about it. You know, how Owen and I have talked about this actually sort of endlessly. Like, how would you... I'm not sure how I would play Kate, right? Because at the end, according to the text, she basically, you know, gives everything up and becomes, you know, his servant to do what he wants with, right? And you know, after he sort of abused her the whole play, I would have trouble as an actress reconciling all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's worse than she becomes his servant. She becomes his property.
Yes.
You know, and the problem is baked into that era because legally speaking, that's what she was. Mm-hmm. I mean, once you're a married woman in Elizabethan England, you are the property of your husband. That's one of the reasons why Queen Elizabeth never got married, because right. it would have she because it would have made for an incredibly difficult legal situation. And her sister, Mary, who had been queen before her, got married to the King of Spain and so became his property. And that was politically disastrous.
Correct.
Although it predated the euro, so it was okay. But to prep for the show, we actually Nicole and I went to see the tragedy of Macbeth.
Oh, the Denzel Washington movie?
Yeah. So that's why last week's episode was interesting, because I was curious your take on it, and we were two thumbs up and you were two thumbs down.
Well, it was beautifully shot. I liked some performances very much. I loved the woman that played the witch. I loved the guy that played Ross, but I was very and I love Denzel Washington and I love Frances McDormand, and I was very disappointed. I don't think that they, and I mean, obviously I know that show backwards and forwards because I played Lady Mac and Macbeth and I've directed it, right? So I know it backwards and forwards, and I just think that there was so much that was just flat. You know, and I didn't see the journey. Like, I didn't see how each of those people got to the crazy at the end. Like, it just sort of like went along and then it was crazy. Right. So for me, I didn't see.
I didn't even see the crazy. I wanted to like that movie so much. And I'm a huge fan of both Coen brothers. Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of Denzel Washington and a huge fan of Frances McDormand. And, you know, the buzz was excellent. Obviously, we're outliers. People are loving that movie. And so I was all kinds of ready. And again, to Lisa Ann's point, it is beautifully shot. I mean, there's no doubt that it is. And I don't mind this. This is not a criticism. Obviously, the way Coen shot that movie, it's very influenced by what Akira Kurosawa did with Throne of Blood, which, by the way, still gets my vote for greatest treatment of that play ever. Mm-hmm. And also by what Wells did with his Macbeth, and also
Wells' Othello too.
Yeah, and his Othello. That's so right. It's kind of an homage to that kind of filmmaking, not only the black and white, but the 4:3 aspect ratio, you know. But that's the style that he wanted to shoot in.
Right.
I don't mind that. I thought it was beautifully composed and beautifully shot. I just thought the acting was boring. You know, I felt that Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington,
they didn't have any chemistry either.
Yeah. And
Mac and Lady Mac, that they are like one of the greatest couples in all Shakespeare, because before it all goes wrong, they're one of the they were one of the greatest couples ever.
Well, not sure. And also, I mean, for my money, they're both too old to be these characters. I mean, could make that feasibly.
Like, they are much older than the characters were in the script.
Right. Lady Macbeth has to be of childbearing years. First of all, she says in no uncertain terms, she says to devil, to either imaginary or real devils,
yes,
take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers.
Yeah.
And then later he says to her, bring forth men children only. You don't say that to somebody that can't have babies.
Right. I'm not saying she went through menopause, but I think she's at the very end of that possibility.
Well, fair. I don't disagree. But with due respect to Frances McDormand, she's not that old. She's older than that.
Yeah.
So, and she's right. That's a problem in telling that story, because also, for my money, one of the crucial things about that play is the fact that A, they don't have children. And B, that they can't have children. And C, that they did have a child that's dead. Mm-hmm. Those are very, very important things in that play. So if you have a situation where that can't be, then you've already denatured the play. And then I just thought, I mean, you know, this is just my two cents, but I felt that both Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand were uncomfortable with that language.
Yeah. And we have like we have a one of our episodes is American Shakespeare versus English Shakespeare, because you know there's a huge school of thought that you have to be English in order to do Shakespeare well. Now, Owen and I don't agree with that, but we kind of felt like this film just kind of supported that view,
Well,
because
Lisa
the
Ann, since
ones that were really good in it were British.
right, but as a great American Shakespearean actor, Lisa Ann, that you are, what did you do in your portrayals of both Macbeth and Lady Macbeth that you didn't see from Denzel and Frances McDormand?
I didn't see a progression.
Okay.
I didn't see a progression because not, you know, I mean, they both go crazy just in different ways. But
Right.
I didn't see any, oh, what's that about? Oh, that seemed a little off. Oh, why is she saying that? Right? Like I didn't see any of that.
I
And
understand. Because
I agree. It kind of was like they just sort of spring the crazy on you at the end.
And it doesn't come out of anywhere, so it's not believable to
if you
me.
watch, and again, I want to endorse what Lisa Ann said in terms of the whole English versus American Shakespeare debate drives me insane. And to me, this movie kind of, well, actually, I guess the reputation of this movie is helping us really because people are loving it. But for me, I was just like, this is another example of two Americans who are not really doing Shakespeare well. But
And not
if
that,
you
and listen, nobody says that they can't do it well.
did you
Right?
see, by the way, that apparent Denzel has, I just, Rodney just
That he
dropped this
wants to do
article.
King Lear.
Yeah, apparently Denzel's going to do Lear on Broadway.
I want to know who's directing it. Like I said, it's not that
Okay.
he can't do it well. I believe
It's,
that. I truly believe that. I
it should be
just think
on
maybe they
Thompson, but it's
didn't have the
not,
right
so I don't
text
know.
crew.
Well, I'm available if anyone's listening.
Right. But I'll give you my two cents. I actually watched the Macbeth with Michael Fassbender for comparison. And I'm guessing you didn't like that either, Owen. I have to say, I thought
It was
Denzel was better
better.
than Michael Fassbender, but I thought Marion Cotillard was better than Frances McDormand.
He was certainly
But I
more, she's
thought,
certainly more in the box casting.
okay, so I guess the one we would send you to, Owen, would be
I would send anyone to the Nicole Williamson,
Nicole Williamson,
Jane
Jane
LaPaterre
LaPaterre.
version, which was made for television in 1980 or
Which
81,
has
somewhere around
Patrick
there.
Stewart in it.
No, it does not.
No,
No, that's the
that's
Hamlet that
the
has
Hamlet,
Patrick Stewart. It's
right.
Nicole Williamson and Jane LaPaterre and mostly people that you haven't heard of, but and that's fantastic. There's also one that Ian McKellen and Judi Dench did right around the same time, that has some well-known people in it, that
That's on
was directed
YouTube.
by Trevor Nunn. And both of those, you can see the Nicole Williamson one on Amazon Prime if you rent it for like $3. I think the one, the Ian McKellen, Judi Dench one is available for free on YouTube.
But if you
But
thought the one you watched was exciting, you should watch one of these two.
yeah, then you'll see those characters the way they really are supposed to be.
But I think we, but the witch was awesome. We can all agree on that. And
Oh my
awesome.
God, she was amazing.
That
Yes.
was fantastic.
Amazing.
Catherine
I
Hunter.
wanted to watch the witch the whole time.
Yes.
Yeah, the witch and the imagery were what I liked the most. I did like some of Denzel's
Realism.
monologues. Like I thought he It was interesting to see. Like it was interesting to see Denzel playing that way. So I enjoyed some of those as
Well,
well.
he's such a great he's a great actor and he's a great presence. So, you know, I mean that he's always going to be interesting to watch. I wanted to love it. I just didn't.
It comes down to this for me. I think they're both better than what we saw as
Agreed.
the actor.
Clearly, and they've been better, obviously, in other movies. But yeah, I was binging on Shakespeare last night. I watched Denzel again in Much Ado About Nothing, which I thought he was better than in that than he was in Macbeth. I saw, but then you know, I also watched the Richard III with Ian McKellen, the movie, and the and Orson Welles' Othello, and I also. Because I needed a palate cleanser, I watched Porky's 2, which has a Shakespearean subplot. I'm not sure if you're aware.
Perfect.
Pee-wee and the gang put on a Shakespearean. And let me ask you, because I can't believe I'm asking the Bardcast about Porky's 2, but the plot of Porky's 2 is it's set in 1950s in the South, and the kids put on Shakespearean play, and they have religious fundamentalists protest it and shut it down. Is that a realistic plot, or is this, you know?
I must confess, I know I've seen Porky's too, but not in a long time. I mostly remember Porky's. But yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, I think it's happening today. Look, they just banned Mouse in Tennessee. So Shakespeare plays are always being banned because they're filled with sex and violence.
Yeah.
Right.
Romeo and Juliet have sex before marriage.
Right.
No, they don't.
I know. Uh-oh. But that's what they think.
They have sex right after marriage.
Right.
But they're teenagers having sex.
They're teenagers.
And it's a play that's filled with sex and violence. So
you could imply that they have sex without it being stated, possibly.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know how you would do that play.
The scene is set in bed after they've had sex. So
right. And the plot kind of turns on it. So it would be really hard to cut that.
Yeah,
but there are definitely plays in which adulterous or premarital sex is featured. Premarital sex is a huge plot point in Measure for Measure, say.
Yeah. Well, and almost all the plays I like also involve a certain amount of witchcraft and borderline paganism.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
And what's interesting about that is, you know, a play like Macbeth might be banned by Christian fundamentalists today. But in fact, one of the reasons why that play is so filled with the occult is because Shakespeare, King James, who was Shakespeare's patron, was fairly new on the throne and was very new as the patron of Shakespeare's company. And he was Scottish and possibly a descendant of Banquo. So Shakespeare wrote a Scottish play to flatter him, but also he was hugely into demonology, the king. Mm-hmm. He wrote a whole book on demonology. He was obsessed with the occult and witches. So the company clearly had the idea of, well, we have a Scottish king who loves demonology. Let's write a Scottish play about demonology and the occult. So they did.
That's cool.
That is very cool. Speaking of cool, Nicole, I don't know if Shakespeare would have involved wanted himself in this, but yeah, it would have used our other sponsor, but maybe he would have. Maybe he needed to relax. Tell us about our other sponsor.
So we are also sponsored by Renegade CBD and Renegade Kush. So if you just want to have a nice, cool vibe and not go crazy, a nice thing to take a little taste and keep your sanity would be the CBD edibles. They're very mild and they're very delicious. We use real confectionists who make the candy themselves, and all the doses are written on the back packages, so you know exactly what you're getting. No tricks. I've had some tricks with CBD, or not with CBD, but with edibles in general, and you don't want to get tricked. So our manufacturing, keeping it honest, is really helpful. So go to renegadekush.com. What?
The gummies are great.
The gummies are great. They're delicious. There's also chocolate, and there's rumored to be white chocolate. I just haven't got a chance to try it yet. So go to renegadecbd.com or renegadekush.com.
Right. Did Shakespeare do drugs?
That's a very people will research every little thing they can find. And we actually mentioned this on a pod, but some people actually found remnants of cannabis in the effects in and around where Shakespeare is known to have lived and worked.
In pipes.
Okay. So possibly.
So Shakespeare was a stoner.
Totally a stoner.
It could be.
I think it was totally a stoner.
Shakespeare had an ill-spent adulthood. I was going to say youth, but it really went the whole way. I mean, he's doing all these questionable legal things and doing drugs. And wow, Shakespeare really is more developed than we thought.
Well, I mean,
more than they teach you, that's for sure.
More than we were taught, yes.
When I said that actors were more or less considered the equivalent of prostitutes, I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I mean, it was an incredibly disreputable position. Now, Shakespeare,
they were the podcasters of their time.
They were the outcast podcasters of their time. Shakespeare became more respectable because he got rich, and he actually he got a coat of arms for his family, which was a great big deal, and got himself declared a gentleman. And like I said, he became wealthy. He had ties
to the crown and all that.
Right. Well, and he made a lot of money. So, yeah. You know, you can buy things. But when he was, he came from a sort of a middle-class family. His father was successful enough that he became the equivalent of the mayor of Stratford. Although then later he apparently had some serious business problems and had a very bad downturn.
Fell from grace.
And Shakespeare never attended university, which is one of the reasons why there's a whole cottage industry of fools who think that Shakespeare didn't write his plays.
Boo, hiss.
You knew that question was coming. Yeah. So he wrote all of his plays?
Well, he, I mean...
Some of his plays he wrote with other people.
Yeah. The best scholarship has increasingly shows that Shakespeare collaborated on a number of his plays, mostly his early plays. And it should be said that, like, speaking of his contemporaries, by far the most popular, or at least the most numerous, most plays were written in collaboration, sometimes by as many as three or four people, but often by two. Common. So when Shakespeare was starting out, his earliest plays are almost certainly written with other writers. And along the way, he collaborated a bit. And at the very end of his career, when he was looking to retire, he wrote his last three plays with a playwright called John Fletcher, who, when Shakespeare retired, took over as the most important house playwright of the King's Men.
Who we talked about on Shakespeare's Contemporaries.
Right, right.
But there's all kinds of ways now. Like there's a semi-science called stylometrics, which involves computers and all kinds of stuff that will look at the way that the handwriting and the typesetting and the word use and the way words are used and in what order to determine who could have written what. Mm-hmm. And so now we know things like Shakespeare wrote the second half of Pericles and not the first half. And that's been pretty much conclusively demonstrated.
Mm.
So it's getting more and more sciencey.
But now, since you're both actors, you're both directors, and you're both, and I know Owen was talking about on the podcast how he saw Olivier's Hamlet, and that's when really Shakespeare clicked in. Lisa, when did Shakespeare click in for you?
So I grew up in New York City and I went from seventh grade to ninth grade because on my third day of seventh grade, after we'd taken this test, somebody used the back of my head for like basketball practice and knocked me out and gave me a concussion. And I'd scored so high in this test, they were like, you can skip a grade. I was like, awesome. So I skipped a grade. And when I got into high school, I was younger than everybody else, but I had an English teacher who made us read Shakespeare out loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the key, like making us read it out loud and making us decipher what it, and he was the kind of guy who would be like, that's a dick joke.
Right.
Which was awesome. So I was
you
exposed
got lucky.
To this, that's right. I was exposed to this amazing teacher in ninth grade when I was 12 or 13. And I was like, oh, my God, there's so much more here than I knew. And then, you know, just followed along from there because I was in college by 16. So.
Wow, well, smarty pants.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I guess that shows you sometimes bullying has its advantages.
That was like 10 or 11, I think, the first time I was exposed to Shakespeare. It was A Midsummer Night's Dream, the one with Stanley Tucci. And
yeah.
And I was like this. And one of my teachers is like, well, if you really like this, you should read the original play. And I loved reading books. Like I started reading at a very young age. So I struggled with it, of course, but I took
the language.
It is. And I just kept reading it and I read different ones. I was like, which ones have the fantasy in it? That's what I was into. And so that was how I originally, I definitely didn't understand what I was reading. But I was excited about it because it was magical.
That's one of the things that I love. One of the reasons why I love to teach a Shakespearean acting is because part of it is the table work is showing kids and adults how to figure out what they're saying. Like there's a bunch of resources. There's a resource called the Shakespeare Lexicon, which has like almost every word in Shakespeare and what it means in that specific usage in that specific play. So there's a way to decipher all of it when you're starting out, but it takes work. But it's so amazing to watch when, you know, like, I've taught it to like, you know, kids age like 11 to 17, you know, in a summer program. And it's amazing to watch when they get it. It's amazing to watch when they figure out that it's a dick joke. You know, that like that enlightenment is such a joy for me. You know,
there's also there's if people aren't aware, there's a really good series of editions called No Fear Shakespeare for people that like so that it will present on one side of the page the actual text of the Shakespeare play, and on the facing side it will have that semi-translated into modern English.
Yeah.
So it's right. Side by side. And that's really helpful for people. But you know, to Lisa Ann's point about the teacher that had them read out loud, I find, you know, because Shakespeare, it's great to read, don't get me wrong. And I love reading Shakespeare, but it wasn't written to be read. It was written to be seen and heard. In fact, in Shakespeare's day, it was more common to say that you were going to hear a play than that you were going to see one. Right. So if you see a well-performed Shakespeare play, it will be much more comprehensible to you than just reading it on the page, especially if you're not familiar with it. You know, a perfect example of this is like I some of the earlier, like that Much Ado of that we were talking about that Denzel is in, that Kenneth Branagh directed. If you see the Branagh movie of Much Ado About Nothing or his Henry V, it's so straightforward and it's so comprehensible because it's these actors who have lived and breathed Shakespeare their entire lives.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just it's much more understandable than just picking it up and trying to slog your way through it.
Yeah, it's second right. nature, you know.
And I know it's meant to be seen on the stage, but and you had a great episode a couple weeks back about you know, favorite Shakespearean actors, naming, you know, all these great, you know, Olivier and Ian McKellen and all these people. What's the worst Shakespeare performance you've seen?
Oh dear. Well, I have to ask, can I say, Lisa Ann, can I say?
Don't say it's Lisa Ann because I'll have to.
No. Lisa Ann, I'm not going to name names, but Lisa Ann and I were fortunate enough to do a production of Twelfth Night many years ago together. That was great fun.
I played Viola. He played Malvolio.
I was Malvolio and Lisa Ann was Viola. Pardon me one second. There is a loud siren going, but I'm going to mute myself just for a moment.
Okay. Usually the sirens are coming here in LA. We had one a couple weeks ago that. Glared through the show, so I understand. This is what happens when you live in a bustling metropolis,
right? Yeah. So Owen and I were. I'll continue this until he has a chance to get back on. But we were in this play together, and the artistic director of the company was also playing one of the lead roles. Are you back, O?
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry, there was an ambulance that was stuck outside my window. Right. Yes. So we won't name names, but this artistic director insisted on playing Orsino in Twelfth Night. And he was a dear man, but he was far too old to be playing Orsino anyway.
To begin with.
And he gave what certainly I think is the worst Shakespearean performance I've ever been on stage with. Mm. If I'd see, because you know, it's weird to say because I didn't see it from the audience point of view, but that might be the worst Shakespeare performance I ever saw.
That was also, I mean, that production in general, that was a mixed bag all the way around.
Yeah, it was, but there was some. It had its moments. It had us.
How do you play off that if somebody's just that bad?
Well, you know, I felt horrible I felt so bad for you, Lisa Ann, because I was Malvolio, so I didn't have shit to do with him.
I had to pretend.
But you had to be in love with him and play all those scenes with him. How did you do it?
Sheer will.
Pardon the pun.
But I will tell you, and, you know, I hate to name names, but this was a professional production and it was Shakespeare in the Park, the public theater in New York at the Delacorte. And it was a production of Twelfth Night and it was after we had done it. And I went to see it and there were some wonderful performances in it. David Harbour, Zach Braff, you know, Christopher Lloyd, like some wonderful people. But Julia Stiles played Viola and she was so outclassed, but the thing was, you could see right from the beginning that she knew how outclassed she was by everybody around her, and it was absolutely painful to watch.
Yeah. Right.
She's an unfortunate Ophelia in the Ethan Hawke Hamlet as well. I hate to say.
Yeah, I never saw the Ethan Hawke Hamlet. Bill Murray doing Shakespeare seems interesting, but maybe
so
not.
So many. There's many, many better Hamlets.
Yeah, I would imagine. I'll be honest. The Keanu Reeves in Much Ado About Nothing lives up to the awful hype. That was pretty bad.
Yeah,
and you know, Out of another one, out of his element, just bad casting.
You know, he did a production of Hamlet in Canada, playing Hamlet.
Oh, yikes.
So think about that, Rosencrantz.
I can't imagine that.
I would stick to John Wick.
I really like Keanu Reeves, too, as a person, but that's not his acting.
Yeah, but then again, his whole appeal is being clueless and maybe this is sort of a Matrixy awakening thing he played. Like, I don't know.
Oh, he's very smart. He said, like, he's a very, like, well-spoken person in real life. That's why I like him so much. But his acting skills don't do serious well.
He's got a thing that's good. He doesn't have range. I mean, he was worse than Dracula. I'll be honest.
Oh, although I guess so some people would argue that John Wick shows he has more of a serious edge. I mean, I might be being too harsh, but until John Wick, he didn't have that.
You gotta give it up to him for attempting it, though.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
On the River's Edge, he was good. He was good in My Own Private Idaho. I mean, he has a little range, but not that much. But oddly enough, people said that Michael Keaton sucked in that, and I thought it was pretty good.
My only problem with Michael Keaton, and I think Michael Keaton is a brilliant actor, I just thought it was, I mean, he was kind of regurgitating Beetlejuice in that movie.
Yeah, people kinda said that. I thought it was more Popeye than Beetlejuice, to be honest with you. Is it more
I mean, it didn't. His performance didn't work for me terribly well in that movie. I mean, it's better than Keanu, but I actually blame Kenneth Branagh for that more than anybody, because Kenneth Branagh let him get away with that choice.
Yeah, and, agreed.
He's such a good actor. I felt Kenneth Branagh could have maybe steered him in another direction
or instructed him into that choice and like run him over the top.
Yeah, who knows?
By the way, Mark, do you know that My Private Idaho is loosely based on both Henry IV's and Henry V?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Do you like when they take Shakespeare stories and tell them in modern times with modern language?
I do if they do it well.
Yeah.
Now that, and that, I have absolutely no problem with taking a Shakespeare play and doing a spin on it, and like My Own Private Idaho, making it its own thing.
Totally.
I often have a problem when people will take a Shakespeare play and, you know, do it in a diner in, you know, New York in 1989, because but on the other hand, it can work brilliantly. I had an acting teacher once years ago that said something that's always stuck with me. He said, if you impose a concept on a Shakespeare play or any play, but it happens so often in Shakespeare, you have to be really sure that you're adding something valuable by doing so, because by the nature of doing so, you're taking something away.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So it can work. Listen, well, I remember years ago, I was dragged kicking and screaming to see a modern dress version of Julius Caesar that was taking place in like present day Washington. And I thought, oh, kill me. Don't kill Julius Caesar, kill me. And yes, I went to see it because I had friends in the cast. And it turned out to be one of the best things I've ever seen, one of the best Shakespeare productions I've ever seen, because the concept worked.
Yeah, and they totally can. I was in a production of Comedy of Errors where they set it in New York, which made sense, right? So there were all of these, you know, the restaurant where that the family owned was in Little Italy, and there was a character from Harlem, and there was a character from Chinatown, and that totally made sense because it fits into the bustling metropolis of that play. That made total sense.
And also, there are plays that you can screw with easier than other plays.
Totally.
If you like, you don't want to mess around too much with a play like King Lear, because it's maybe the greatest play ever written. Comedy of Errors is cute. It's early. But so you know what? If you want to play around with a Comedy of Errors, be my guest.
Now, and you directed a production of The Tempest that was nominated for a lot of awards for its innovation. What was so innovative about that?
Well, it was what we call immersive theater. If you're familiar with that,
that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, so we didn't do it in a traditional theater. It was produced by the Secret Theater, which has a their own space in Queens, but we did it in this enormous art gallery called the Plaxall Art Gallery in Long Island City, which is this. I think it's something like 8 or 9,000 square feet, in weird shapes, and it's got 25-foot high ceilings. So you know, we didn't have the audience come and sit down and watch it; they followed it around. So first of all, we did it multimedia style with all kinds with music and projections and all kinds of crazy shit. And I had a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant choreographer named Shoko Tamai, who is the head of a company called the Ninja Ballet. She's just a genius. And we had, the spirits of the island were dancers. So we had a dance element, we had music, we had projection. And we brought the audience, we made the audience follow the action around the gallery. So it was like they were part of the island themselves. And part of the action, really. So that's what we mean by immersive. And I'll tell you this, my sister's also a theater director, and she likes to say, you ponder about taking a project and just have to you always have to decide if it's going to be worth the pound of flesh that it always takes from you. Mm. Cause it does. It's a huge labor. And this Tempest was one of the biggest scale productions that I've ever directed. And it was really, really hard. But at the end of the day, I was really proud of it when we were done.
It's hard not to block for a black box. Yeah. But how do you block if you're always moving?
Well, it's funny. It's the closest that I've never directed a film, but I had to think cinematically. I had to think in three dimensions because it was three dimensional. I couldn't think of it the way you normally think of staging a play. It pushed me and in a really good way. It was exhausting and difficult, but I'm very glad that I did it.
I would love the opportunity to direct a Shakespeare immersively. The only thing I've ever directed immersively was a production of Rocky Horror that I set in. It was literally in an S&M dungeon.
Right. Well, that's right up our alley.
Oh my God, it was amazing. Like Rocky was felt like discovered on the bondage wheel and stuff. It was really cool.
Perfect. And that's what I love about you guys is you can just quote Shakespeare at the top of the hat. You're just a really great mix of the sacred and the profane, but Lisa Ann, you acted in a production that really stands on your resume, Chicks with Dicks, about bikers.
Yeah, so Chicks with Dicks, or as it in parentheses, Bad Girls on Bikes Doing Bad Things.
Bad Girls on Bikes, yes.
I play this character, Vespa D'Amour, who is the runner-up of her runner-up prom in prom queen, I guess, first runner-up. And then she lives near Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, which is, nuclear, as she says in the play. And the first time she has sex, because she's lived in near Three Mile Island, her hormones undergo this craziness and a penis grows out of her forehead. And then she becomes the leader of Satan's Cherries, which is one of the female biker gangs.
Wow.
Yeah, so, she wakes up in the land beyond gender. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's a different Chicks with Dicks than I'm used to. My goodness.
That's pretty nuts. That's wild.
Did the dick ever fall off?
No.
I'm assuming you had to glue it to your head.
Yeah, no, it never did. And it was big, too.
Wow.
Well, good. If you're going to grow a dick out of your forehead. Yeah, how come I've never seen these pictures?
You have. Get out.
I've never seen those pictures.
Really? All right.
Really?
On. Well,
when did you guys meet? I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm guessing it was a production.
Before there were toilets. No.
We actually met, and this is like from our checkered past. But Lisa Ann and I worked at the Jekyll and Hyde Club here in New York City. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was an interactive restaurant.
No, please enlighten me.
Oh my God. This is many, many years ago. It was a theme restaurant. A theme restaurant, which was like sort of like the Adventurers Club at Disney, right? So it's like you have all these animatronic puppets and it's like a spooky library and a spooky laboratory and all this stuff. And actors were hired to populate the club basically and run around being different characters, mad scientists, mm-hmm. adventurers, that kind of thing. And also go into the control booth and operate the puppets. So I was hired sometime in the 90s to do this job for my sins. And I was fortunate enough that the very first day, the person that I was assigned to trail was none other than Miss Lisa Ann Goldsmith. And we soon discovered that it was very bizarre that we hadn't met until that time, because we had spent many, many years missing each other, like just barely.
By a
like,
day.
We knew all the same people. We'd worked in a lot of the same places. We just never had run into each other. So we've known each other and been friends for about 30 years, but we should have been friends much longer than that.
Right.
It's true.
And post-pandemic, I'm catching up with people that I should have met a long time ago, but and we're always in circles. And you're like, well, I don't know how I never met you, but here you are.
Yep. But it's amazing.
Here's a picture of, I'll put
yeah,
it
you
in
gotta
the chat.
Unblur.
I gotta unblur. So hold on one second. I'll put it in the chat.
If you could,
I'm excited. Yeah, I've never seen.
If you could send me a shout out, if you can email that to me, that'd be great.
I totally will.
I'll put that on the YouTube on this, and we'll figure it out. We'll see if YouTube can notices it, but you never can tell. But Lisa, you've been in movies too. As a talented and experienced Shakespearean actress, director, teacher, everything that you do. You're in a movie with Russell Crowe for like 30 seconds. How frustrating is that?
So this is a great story. I'm going to tell you this story.
So
I play a prison guard that's supposed to break up a fight between Russell Crowe and Elizabeth Banks. So I get on set. Russell's not there. I meet Elizabeth. I meet Paul Haggis, who's, you know, the Academy Award winning director. Everything's cool. We're waiting 20 minutes, 30 minutes. After an hour and 5 minutes after everybody's already on set, Russell comes on, doesn't talk to anybody, sits down at the table. Paul says, do you want to run lines? He's like, yeah, we run the lines. He's never looked at me. He's never said hello, nothing like that. So we go to the first take and Paul has said to me, I want you to get in Russell's face. I'm like, okay, whatever you say. So first take comes and I get in Russell's face and he like kind of looks a little surprised and backs up, but then like does his line and goes on. We do that take a few more times. They go to change camera angles and I'm standing there talking to my friend who's one of the props guys. And I hear Lisa Ann. I'm looking around. I don't know who that is. I'm talking to my friend. I hear Lisa Ann. I look over. It's Russell. He's sitting at the table. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, come here. I walk over to the table. I'm like, yeah. And he says, no, come here. So I lean on the table. I'm like, yeah. And he says, you can't stand on your mark. You know, the X where you're supposed to stand for camera. And I'm like, that's my mark. Thinking Academy Award winning director Paul Haggis told me to stand there. Fuck you. Right. So he goes, well, look behind you. I'm like, yeah. He's like, you see that camera? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, when you're standing on your mark, I can't be seen by that camera. And that's not good. And I said, that's not good for you. And he just like looked at me and then he burst out laughing. And from that moment on, I was his favorite person on set. Because I stood up to him. He like bought me beers at the rap party, you know, because I was just like, bitch, you're just luckier than me. It doesn't mean you're any more talented, you know?
That's always the way. Everybody... Once you stand up to one of these, you know, quote unquote bullies, then you're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hit the shark on the nose.
Exactly.
I was like, really, now, dude? Come on.
So yeah, I can't believe. First off, I don't think he's like that now, but boy, that's pretty devious.
It makes me think of his mean tweet, which I believe was, Russell Crowe is delightfully paradoxical in that he is a huge dick with a tiny penis.
Yeah. You guys would know better than I would. Maybe Lisa Ann's got a bigger dick on her forehead. But, oh, and when you, you've been producing, directing. Now, you've been producing plays for a long time. You produced, you really got a name for producing a play with the humorous Quentin Crisp, if people are not. You must have a Quentin Crisp story.
If anybody remembers Quentin Crisp, he was if people have seen The Naked Civil Servant, that was the book that made him famous, and later a movie with John Hurt playing him. And he was one of these people. He was basically famous for being famous. He was a pioneer, like as a gay man. He was out in England before anybody was out, And, you know, and he suffered for it. And he moved to America as an older gentleman. And he lived a block away from my family when I was young. And my mother's English. So she found out that he was in the neighborhood and he was in the phone book. He like listed himself in the phone book deliberately so people would, you know, be in touch with him. So my mom just called him and they became friends. And I was a young man. I was about 20 and I had started this theater company called The Facemakers. And we had decided to do The Importance of Being Earnest. And I was sitting around with my family, actually, who are all in show business, and we were talking about casting the show. And we didn't really have anybody to play Lady Bracknell. If people know that show, it's a fabulous old, you know, like the battle axe to end all battle axes. And somebody, wasn't me, somebody said, well, what about asking Mr. Crisp to do it? And this was before, and there's now a tradition of men playing this part. And frankly, Mr. Crisp playing that part is one brilliant. Of the things that started that tradition because it became a notorious production. But you know, it hadn't happened yet. Somebody said that, and I said, oh my God, that's fucking brilliant, but he'll never say yes. So, you know, we invited him to dinner and got him drunk. And, you know, at the end, well, I mean, not drunk, but, you know, we plied him with alcohol.
You roofied Quentin Crisp.
I roofied Quentin Crisp with cognac. And when, you know, at the end of the evening, after he had a full belly and a few in him, I asked him and I prepared it very carefully. And, you know, I offered him a percentage of the box office and this and that, but I knew there wouldn't be much. And I asked him if he would play Lady Bracknell. And in his inimitable dulcet tones, he replied, "Of course I shall do whatever you want." And then he did. And it was quite something. You know, it was a fairly notorious production. And I'll never forget, I was manning the box office. And towards the end of the run, I got a phone call from Studio 54. If people remember the infamous Studio 54.
The biggest disco club ever.
Yeah. And they wanted to talk to me. And I was like, okay, what is this about? And they said, we understand that you are the producer of this production of The Importance of Being Earnest starring Quentin Crisp, and we would love to throw a closing night party for you guys if you can make sure that Mr. Crisp will be there and be available for photographs. And I said, I'm sorry, what? So we did that, and it was pretty cool. But he was not, I should say, he was no diva. He was not a diva at all. He was the sweetest person you would ever want to meet.
And put in the work.
I don't have a Russell Crowe-ish story to tell.
Well, they're not all like.
He was an old sweetheart.
I just did.
Quentin Crisp as a dancer.
Say that again.
How was Quentin Crisp as a dancer?
He wasn't a dancer at all.
Like in Studio 54, could he boogie?
I see what you mean.
Was he doing the hustle? Or what have you?
No. We just went when that night came, he did not go down on the dance floor at all. We went up to the highest, if you were over there back in the day, but they had different bars on different levels. Right. And on the highest level, they had a private bar. So he took some photographs downstairs in the main room, and then they whisked him up to the top floor, and I kind of came along with him. And he just stayed at the bar and sat at a table and let people take pictures of him.
That's nice.
So I mean, by that point, he was close to 80.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. But, you know, they did buy me beers at the wrap party, so I guess.
That's the common denominator, seems to be liquor. Owen, you're going to say something? I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm actually looking at the picture of Lisa Ann with the dick on her forehead.
Oh, yeah, I put it in the chat.
Yeah, that is something. That is a big dick.
It is a big dick.
But
wow.
I know.
You have hidden talents.
Yes.
You've been holding out on me all these years.
Right.
Can't give you all the info right away.
When you ask somebody to send your face, there's a double meaning. But anyway, that's speaking of inappropriateness and dicks, tell Nicole the story about how the podcast, the Bardcast, got its name, because it has to do with the Renaissance Fair, which is something my ex-girlfriend used to be a Renaissance Fair regular, so I have mixed feelings, but go ahead.
Well, Mark, I bet you will know what I mean when I say that bikers love Ren Fairs.
Mm-hmm.
They do. And Lisa Ann has a good theory as to why this is.
I do?
Yeah.
What is that?
You've always said tits and turkey legs.
Oh yeah, that's right. Tits, of course. Tits and turkey legs.
So we were
at the New York Renaissance Festival, and they were doing, they did an equity Shakespeare, you know, and if you paid to come into the fair, you could come and see the show for free. And so that year was As You Like It, and they started it, and there were two bikers sitting in the front row, you know, looking for tits and with their turkey legs. And about 15, 20 minutes into the production, they got up and started walking out in the middle of the production. And as they were leaving, the first biker turned to the second biker and goes, "What the hell was that?" And the second biker said, "Owen,
what was that? It's Shakespeare, you dick." And everyone in the audience and everyone on stage heard this and burst into laughter. And that story became a legendary story at the Ren Fair.
Yep.
So when we were starting the podcast, we thought, well, we have to.
And actually, because of the name of our podcast about Shakespeare, Chase Bank let us open a business account.
Oh, this is hilarious.
Closed us down because they thought we had something to do with porn.
So I guess the Shakespeare censorship continues from Pork Stew through Chase Bank and everything else. But boy, this hour has flown by so fast. I do have, unless Nicole's got another question.
No, I've been already speaking up when I hear things that intrigue me, and I think that it's really cool how they got the name.
Yeah, the last question, and I you kind of deal with this, on every episode, but I want to hear both of you, your opinion why Shakespeare is so relevant now in 2022. And it, and by the way, Nicole, I recommend the episode about the diseases in Shakespeare's time, which is definitely relevant. But and boy, that was, I got to tell you, I love that episode. That was some crazy stuff.
Right. Some,
oh yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Why? And I'd love to have you guys back on, talk to you guys again. But I guess the last question, as I said, what is it about these plays that are still relevant in 2022? Some more relevant than a lot of plays that have come on since.
Well, here's the thing about William Shakespeare: is he, when he wrote, he understood the human condition better than any other playwright I can think of, or certainly, you know, in the top three. You know, people are people. It doesn't matter whether they were living at 1590 or 2022. Everybody loves, everybody hates, everybody wants revenge, everybody's poor, everybody shits, everybody farts. It's all the same. And he really hits to the core, I think, of how human beings behave and what we're made of.
Well,
by the way, Nicole doesn't fart, but everybody else does. So go ahead, Mom.
I was going to say also, since we've spent a lot of time talking about Macbeth, I mean, the story of a narcissistic megalomaniac that comes to power and wants nothing but power and corrupts himself and everyone around him by the pursuit of power. Does that sound familiar in 2022?
Yes,
and are we not beset by gang violence? Is that not a huge issue in this country? Well, look at Romeo and Juliet if you want to play about gang violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of crazily relevant, the stuff that you write.
And racism and anti-Semitism, it's all in
there. I was going to ask that too. Was Othello in that time as scandalous as far as the interracial love, or even more so?
Well, it's, you know, when we throw, it's very hard to use words like racism and apply them to Shakespeare because there was no such concept then, you know.
Right.
But certainly, I mean, you know, Shakespeare had probably met or seen some Black people and maybe possibly met a couple of Jews, but maybe not, you know.
Right.
So, but certainly the concept of interracial marriage would have been very, very taboo in Shakespeare's England. But one of the things that's very interesting about Othello, and especially if you compare Othello, I'm going to go down the rabbit holes and I know we're over time, but if you compare Othello with The Merchant of Venice, it's interesting because Othello is Shakespeare's most famous and prominent Black character, and Shylock is his most prominent Jewish character, and they both appear in front of the same body. They appear in front of the Signory of Venice and have to deal with the Doge of Venice. Right. And the Doge of Venice in The Merchant of Venice is very, 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 very bad to Shylock. Looks down on him, treats him very poorly. But in Othello, he treats Othello with nothing but respect. And in fact, when the senator whose daughter Othello has married is complaining, after a while, the Doge of Venice says, I think my daughter would have married him too.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
You know, so Othello is treated with great respect where Shylock is not, by the same body. Make of that what you will.
So Shakespeare was an anti-Semite.
Oh boy, is that a
No, big I'm kidding. I'm kidding. That's another joke, please. Stop it. I gotta be controversial. Come on, I'm trying to get those Joe Rogan numbers. Anyway, Lisa Ann and Owen, what a delight. You guys have been great. Tell everybody your website, your contact information, how people can get a hold of you, and you know, as how they can listen to this award-winning great podcast.
You can visit our website at www.thebardcastyoudick.com. Or you can send us an email if you have anything to say about what we said. We love it. We welcome it. We encourage it at thebardcastyoudick@gmail.com.
And you can get our podcast either on our website or pretty much anywhere you get your podcast. We're on all the
characters. Yeah, we're still on Spotify too. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Right. My whole thing on that is, he's got his show. You don't have to listen to it.
Right.
Listen to our show.
I agree.
Listen
to your show. I agree. Free speech.
Free speech. But anyway, and you have any productions coming up, Owen or Lisa Ann?
I actually recently became the artistic director of the Schoolhouse Theater, which is a theater here in New York State in Westchester. And we're in pre-production for a new play called Grant and Twain, which tells the story of the friendship of Ulysses Grant and Mark Twain. And later this fall, I'm going to be directing the Westchester premiere of Red by John Logan, which was a Tony Award winning show a few years ago on Broadway.
Wonderful.
That's a story of Mark Rothko, the painter.
I have nothing at the moment, but I was really busy during the pandemic.
You sure were.
I got to do, I mean, during the last summer, I got to play the Wicked Witch of the West and Miss Gulch in a production of The Wizard of Oz at Heinz Field, which was really fun.
Wow.
Yeah, that was really
fun. At a baseball stadium, a football stadium? Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
That was awesome. I got to see it, thank God, because there's a recording of it. And I got to tell you, that was the part you were born to play.
Oh, pshaw. Well,
wherefore art thou so awesome? Owen and Lisa Ann, this has been a delight. Nicole, how do people get a hold of you?
I'm at Nicole Six Books on Instagram and Nicole H6 on Facebook.
This has been a joy, you guys.
Such really fun, you guys.
And I'm Goth Comedian on all social media. We had such a fun time. Let's do it again sometime down the road. And everybody, have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.
Bye.